The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing. Not because they are easy, but
we have main engine start. 4, 3, 2, 1.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston. Broadcasting to 7 continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Space Show. I am your host, David Livingston. Great to be back. And let's get started. Let me give you the call-in and email information and tell you about our show today. For those of you who do want to call us, our toll-free number is 1-866-687-7223. Remember, no call screeners, and you can come in without any restrictions, nothing. Just call and you'll get on the show. Please wait until we answer the phone, and please be patient. We'll bring you up on air just as quickly as possible. Again, that number, 1-866-687-7223. And then email drspace@thespaceshow.com, thespaceshow@gmail.com, and also you can use dmlivings@yahoo.com. And chat is on the AOL family, IMICQ, or CompuServe. The screen name is the same for all of these services. One word, Space Show Chat. Please remember, we're trademarked and copyrighted. You do have permission to download shows and copy them and spread them around and share them. Please, nothing commercial. And also, don't change or modify the text of any of the interviews. Special thanks to Andrew at gigadial.net. He does do our podcasting for us. The RSS URL is on our website and both of our newsletters, so it's an easy subscribe for you. We're iTunes compatible, Podcast Alley, and a host of other places. If you have any questions or issues or problems with our podcast, please let me hear from you at drspace@thespaceshow.com. And our website, thespaceshow.com, has a comprehensive newsletter. You can't miss it. It's about a fourth of the way down the page. It's uploaded every Monday morning, California time. This newsletter has all of the guest bios on it for the week, details of the guest shows, plus future events. It's also where we make announcements and change programming if we have to, so please check it from time to time. If you want the short email version of the newsletter, send me a note at drspace@thespaceshow.com. It has only one or two lines about the programs for the week, guaranteed not to clutter up your inbox, but at least it tells you what's happening. Remember, everything we do is archived. We're approaching 1,200 shows now. You can listen to them off of our website. You can easily download them. No login, no registration, nothing like that required. We do have a store on our website, and, of course, we have the support the Space Show button. Remember, please, we're a 501c3 nonprofit with One Giant Leap Foundation, and we do need your support. We couldn't do the show without your support. Thank you to all of you who have supported us and to those of you who will support us. A couple of other quick announcements. Remember, Ken has an unofficial bulletin board for the Space Show at planetspace.com. Check it out. Let me know what you think of it, if you're using it or not. Remember, we do Twitter, MySpace, and Facebook. And also remember that we are partially brought to you by the Secure World Foundation, which promotes cooperative solutions for space security. You can get more info on them at their website, secureworldfoundation.org. As for hold the dates, just a couple. Mars Society is right around the corner, July 30th to August 2nd. They're on the University of Maryland campus this year at College Park, Maryland, and their website is marssociety.org. And AIAA has the Joint Propulsion Conference August 2nd to the 5th in Denver, Colorado at the Colorado Convention Center, AIAA.org. And SmallSat is August 10th through the 13th. in Logan, Utah, and you can still go there as well, smallsat.org. I will be at the SmallSat conference. So, you know, do check it out, and if you're at SmallSat, let me know. It'd be nice to meet you and to see those of you who I already know again. It's an honor for me to welcome back to the show Dr. Paul Spoudis. He's the PI in the Planetary Geology Program at NASA's Office of Space Science Solar System Exploration Division, specializing in research on the processes of impact and volcanism on the planets. And his full bio is going to be up on the page, but he is also known as probably one of the point men, one of the point scientists, a real expert on why we should be headed back to the moon and what the impact of that is and all sorts of good information related to our return to the moon. I just came from the New Space Conference at NASA Ames that all of you know because I've been talking about it. And Paul was one of the speakers on the last day of the conference and an outstanding presentation. And he was besieged by people after his talk because of what he had to say, the content which was so important, and how he was able to reach people. His full bio will be up on the website when I archive this program. However, now we're going to talk to him. So, Dr. Spoudis, welcome back to the program. How are you?
I'm fine. Thank you very much, David.
Okay. Why should we go back to the moon? As I told you before the show started, when this comes up on the show, overwhelmingly people say, to heck with the moon. We need to go directly to ANEO, and we're going to inspire the youth of America and change the course of America for all time in our future. And if we don't do ANEO, we need to be headed directly to Mars, and that, too, will inspire and change the focus of everybody, and we'll reinstate STEM education, and we'll have 100 years of glorious gold education and everything else with it. So where does the moon fit into all this?
Well, I think fundamentally, I'm not against any of those things. I mean, I also want to go to the asteroids, and I want to go to Mars, and I want to go to all the planets. But fundamentally, the basic problem is we do not have a system at the moment that can routinely go there, or even go there with a great degree of difficulty. And fundamentally, what we need to develop is a way to routinely access the various points in space that we want to go to for whatever reason, either for science or for economic reasons or for national security reasons. So the moon is an important transitional object in that regard because it has the material and energy resources that we need to actually start creating spacefaring capability from the stuff that we find in space. And in fact, that really is fundamentally the reason that the moon is the centerpiece of the vision for space exploration.
So because of the moon's assets, so to speak, I guess as well as its location, it's our starting point and our taking off point. Is that a good way of saying it?
Yeah, I think so. It is the nearest place beyond low Earth orbit that actually has material resources that we can use. Now, the whole resource thing, I think, is fundamental. One of the things that's holding us back in space is that it costs a lot of money to get there. And the reason it costs a lot of money is because you have to spend a lot to work against the incredibly deep gravity well that we happen to live in, which is the Earth's surface. In fact, if you look at it, we're barely able to get into Earth orbit. If the chemical bonds of certain compounds were just slightly stronger, we wouldn't be able to break them and actually combust a rocket to generate enough energy to go into Earth orbit. So in spending all of your effort just to get to the first rung on the ladder basically leaves you sort of bereft when you get to low Earth orbit. You don't have the fuel or the capabilities to go beyond that. The way to create that so that you can routinely do that is to actually start using what you find in space to create what you need. And that's the role of the moon. The moon has those resources. The more we learn about it, the more interesting it is. And in many ways, I think it is the place where we're going to learn how to live and work on another world. In fact, that's what I would like NASA to adopt as the mission statement for going back to the moon.
Is that their mission statement, or do they even have a mission statement for going back to the moon?
They do not. And I'm a little bit, in one way I'm mystified by this, and in another I'm not. When the vision was first announced in January 2004, President Bush actually used specific phrases like learning to use the resources of the moon in his speech. It was also in the White House document that accompanied that speech. When that policy was debated and endorsed by two Congresses, that same language was incorporated into their versions as well. So to my mind, that's about as clear a direction as an executive agency can get, that they were fundamentally told what their mission to the moon was, and their mission to the moon was to go there and learn to use what you find on the moon to create spacefaring capability. And they have not embraced that. I think there's two reasons for that. One is that there's a strong constituency in the agency that sees the vision strictly as a manned Mars mission, and the moment the vision was announced, they tried to torque it in that direction. The second reason is I think that NASA has a fundamental aversion to this mission on the grounds largely that they're not sure that it can work, that it's going to the moon and doing sorting missions to explore a la Apollo on steroids, if you want to call it that, is something they know how to do. They think they know how to do it. Going there and extracting what you need to live out of the materials that you find there is something they don't know how to do. It's also something they don't know if it's possible or not. So therefore, they're averse to this mission on those grounds because it's a risky mission. It's a mission at which they might fail.
Well, if they were going directly to a NEO or to Mars, they'd want to live off the land, so to speak, too. So why do they think that they could pull that one off and not going to the moon, which is easier, closer, much closer to home in case there's a problem? If they can't do it on the moon, why would they do it on Mars or a NEO?
Well, I'm not sure that they are going to do it on Mars or a NEO. I mean, if you look at the Mars reference architecture, they basically plan an end-to-end Mars mission very much in the Apollo mode. Everything is launched from the Earth, everything is taken with them to Mars, and everything that they need is brought back with them on the way home. And ISRU is something they just talk about in vague generalities. They talk about maybe using planetary resources in the future. In terms of near-Earth asteroid missions, there's zero incorporation of asteroidal resources in any architecture I've seen for a human mission to asteroids. So the simple fact is that they're afraid of ISRU on the moon, but they're afraid of it on all the other objects as well. They're really looking at the main reason they want to bypass the moon is their perception that they have done what they can do on the moon. And perhaps for NASA, that's true. It's certainly not true for the spacefaring community at large.
Well, that's true, but, you know, the spacefaring community at large isn't going to have any access, and if they think they're going to take over the NASA hardware to go to the moon at the high cost that they're coming up with, I mean, I can't see any private company doing that.
No, they're not, and in fact, that's why I've spent so much time and energy trying to point out to whoever will listen that the original purpose of the vision was for NASA to go to the moon to start learning how to do these things, largely as a way to develop new technology, to develop new skills. In fact, NASA's mission is not to go and colonize the moon or to industrialize the moon, but rather it's to go to the moon to find out and answer the questions, can the moon be inhabited? Can the moon be industrialized? And so it's NASA, in this case, is playing the role of a risk mitigation agent. They are taking the lead on highly leveraging technology that may or may not be successful, but in fact it's their job to find out if it can be or not.
And it sounds like they're reluctant to find out.
Well, it sounds like, absolutely, they're reluctant to find out. I mean, when right after the ESAS was adopted and the work started on building the Orion and the Ares, the first thing that was chopped out, there were two things that were chopped out to make money when they first ran into money difficulties. The first was the series of robotic missions, which would have acquired the strategic knowledge we need to find out how to utilize lunar resources. The second thing that was chopped out was any kind of research in ISR, in resource processing. So both of those things, which are critical technologies to going back to the moon, were the first ones thrown out the door.
You've got a question from John in Boston, and John says, how relevant is what you would learn on the moon in zero gravity with no atmosphere to going to Mars that has some gravity and has some atmosphere?
Well, the moon does have gravity. It has about half the gravity that Mars does. And the atmosphere of Mars is pretty thin. It's 5 millibars, which is basically 5/1000ths of a Earth atmospheric pressure at sea level. You cannot live on Mars without pressure suits. You can't live on Mars without protecting yourself from solar UV and cosmic radiation. You're going to have to move large quantities of granular material on Mars to do resource processing if you want to extract water from the subsurface. All of those things are common to any resource processing scheme, because your task in resource processing is to take what you find and basically process it in such a way as to make what you need. And so all of those skills, all of those procedures, all of those technologies that will have to be developed for the moon are equally relevant to wherever you go, wherever what other objects you go to study and to use. You're going to be using there's going to be a lot of commonality in both the technology and the equipment. So the moon is a very good training ground for that, because for one thing, we're much better informed about the nature of the feedstock from the moon than we are for either an asteroid or Mars. We have meteorite samples that we think are derived from these bodies, but we do not know, in fact, how their uppermost surfaces are really configured in detail, because we've never been there.
June in San Diego says this by email. This is a no-brainer to most thinking people. The moon takes us into an incremental transition period of learning how to do things in space, which we seem to have totally lost. Look, we can't even get together and build a rocket that will take us to the moon. How in the hell does anyone think we could go to Mars and manage a trip to Mars and come back with the astronauts alive and do anything on Mars? We absolutely need the moon as our learning base and to kind of start all over again. I don't understand how this is lost on so many people that seem to know what they're talking about with space. Can you try to explain to us why this fundamental thing, this fact that we need to learn how to do things in space, and the moon is the most cost-effective, safest way to learn how to do these things, is lost on so many people?
Well, that's an interesting question. I'm not sure that it's lost on them. I think it's that they refuse to accept it. I mean, they may understand that argument, but they reject it. And they reject it largely on the grounds, I believe, that the architecture and the mission plans that NASA has come up with for returning to the moon, in fact, are largely a repeat of Apollo, at least in the sense of making lunar science and exploration the fundamental mission objective, which completely misses the point of the vision. So I can see where they're coming from. Their thought is that going back to the moon to do Apollo-style exploratory sorties doesn't really give you the skills you need to go beyond the moon. And in a way, there's a point to that. But at the same time, that really wasn't the intent of going to the moon in the first place.
So are we not telling the story correctly for people to understand this?
Well, I don't think NASA is telling the story correctly at all. And in fact, if you go to their website and you look, go to the ESMD section, the exploration section, and click on, you know, why are we going to the moon, you'll get a very nice little poster that's got 6 themes to it. And they're nice motherhood statements about advancing science and improving education and technical spinoff, and it's the usual stuff that NASA does. But fundamentally, it's all very nebulous. A list of 6 themes associated with lunar exploration is not a mission statement. And I've always been of the belief that if you can't make your mission statement one sentence, if you can't state it in one sentence, you probably don't understand it. And for the last 5 years, I've been trying to get NASA to adopt a mission statement to the moon. And here's what I've come up with. I think this encapsulates what we want to do on the moon. We're going to the moon to learn the skills and develop the technologies we need to live and work productively on another world. Now, if they were to adopt that as their mission statement, I think that it would be very easy to judge whether a certain program or a certain technology or a certain approach is relevant to the mission or not. And in the absence of that, all you're doing is arguing details about which booster rocket to build, when arguably NASA shouldn't be building one at all.
Well, having just come from New Space and having that in my mind. All I hear is we go back to the moon to stay, permanent settlement. I don't hear anything like what you're talking about out of the space enthusiast community. I didn't hear much of it among the advocates and the enthusiasts at New Space. It's all about we can't do what we did last time. We have to go there to stay. We have to build a long-term settlement. But that's a little different than what you're talking about.
Well, not really. I mean, going back to the moon to stay involves learning to find what you need to live on the moon. I mean, if you're going to the moon to actually create a thriving, sustainable settlement, then there's no question you have to understand how to extract what you need out of the local materials. All I'm saying is that I'm specifically directing my comments to the way NASA is approaching the lunar return. The way they're approaching the lunar return is largely a redo of Apollo. It's building a system that looks very Apollo-like. The Altair lander looks very limb-like, although it's much bigger than it has to be, I think. And they want to conduct missions that go to a wide variety of places all over the lunar globe and do great exploration. And they talk about pressurized rovers and 100-kilometer traverses. And as a lunar scientist, I think that's great. That's wonderful. The problem is that doesn't really advance our task on the moon. And, for example, if you're going to the moon to stay, the last thing you want to do is send each mission to a different place. Because what that does is that spreads all of your assets globally around the moon where none of them can support each other. Ideally, what you want to do is pick the best spot you can from the knowledge you have or can acquire from robotic precursors and then land and build up your infrastructure there and immediately start making product, making consumables, air and water, making rocket propellant, generating electricity. Once you start doing that and once you get to a critical stage where you have an abundance of those commodities, then you can stage your global exploration from the lunar base, not from the Earth, which makes infinitely more sense to me.
Do you think there's any chance that NASA might hear what you and a few others are saying with the new administrator coming in?
I don't know. I mean, I've been saying this through three administrators now. I mean, the division was announced under Sean O'Keefe, and then Mike Griffin came in, and now we have Charlie Bolden, and the first two, I don't think, really appreciated what the mission was. It remains to be seen whether Mr. Bolden will appreciate it or not. I certainly hope he does.
This is Alice in Denver, Colorado. Says David brings up an interesting point when the vision comes up on the space show, and that is how much of the general public has to be on board to have an effective space policy. In this case, let's limit it to an effective return to the moon along the lines you're talking about. Do we need public support? Can the enthusiastic space community and the professional space community carry this for the right votes in Congress? If we do need general population support in a country of 300 million, what's the magic number for people who have to even know that there's a return to the moon program and who have to care about what we're talking about today?
Well, that's a very good question, because I think that kind of cuts to the nub of NASA's dilemma. And I think the magic number is 50%.
Wow.
I further think that we have that number and have had that number for roughly the last 40 years. Now, let me back up a minute and explain. I'll tell a little story about when I was on the Aldridge Commission 4 years ago. We got a presentation from NASA that showed us polling data that Gallup had conducted over the years, basically from the early 60s through the present. And every year, Gallup conducts a poll, randomly selected adults, and they ask the question, do you approve or disapprove of the National Space Program? And the interesting thing to me was that no matter what NASA was doing, whether going to the moon or trying to build a space shuttle or recovering from a shuttle accident or building the station, for the last 40 years, that number has been approved, disapproved, has been roughly 50-50, plus or minus 10%. Sometimes it's 58-42 in favor. Sometimes it's 52-48 against. But it always hovers around 50-50. Now, I think that's a significant number. What that tells me is that the public, in large part, the voting public is indifferent to space. They're not against it. They're not against the space program. They don't want to gut it and see it eliminated and have spend money on something else. But they're not overly enthusiastic about it either. Now, here's the key part. I mean, if you accept that as for the sake of argument, NASA approaches that and they see a problem. They say, we've got to come up with something that gets people excited about space. I see it as an opportunity. Because what it tells me is, if people are largely indifferent to what you're trying to do in space, then you have a large degree of freedom for exactly what you want to do. So it's just as easy under that kind of environment to create an architecture that incrementally and cumulatively builds upon itself and on the long term gives you great capability. It's just as easy to do that as it is to develop a showbiz spectacular with flags and footprints somewhere. Now, NASA doesn't look at it that way. They look at they're wedded to the Apollo template. They think Apollo was their moment of glory, so they're looking for another Apollo. And the best they can come up with in that vein is flags and footprints to Mars. And so that's fundamentally the way they oriented the agency. That's the way they're interpreting the vision, because in their minds that was their glory days. But in actual fact, if the public is indifferent to what you're doing, it doesn't really matter what path you choose, because they're going to be indifferent to it whichever way you go. Now the real question is what evidence do I have that this indifference translates to support? Well, the evidence I have is if you look at the budget for the last 30 years, it's been more or less constant in constant dollars. Since about 1970, we've spent anywhere from 0.5% to 1% of the federal discretionary budget on space, and that has been constant throughout the cycle of the shuttle, after the Challenger disaster, during station, and after Columbia. It's always come in between 0.5 and 1%. And what that tells me is that that level of spending is sustainable. It's sustainable politically, and my evidence for that is that it has been sustained for the last 30 years. Therefore, your task is to figure out a way to do the things you want to do under that kind of budgetary environment. And I've written on this on my blog. I mean, the question is, does NASA get enough money? Well, of course, if you ask any agency, they're going to say, of course we don't get enough money. You need to double our budget immediately. I mean, that's a no-brainer. But the simple fact is, if you approach the problem differently, if to borrow the Apple computer model, think different. If you approach it such that you want to build a program with small, incremental, cumulative steps, with constant funding, you can actually accomplish quite a bit. So the free variable this time is not money, but time. So I know I've gone a long way around the barn, but to sum up what I'm trying to get at, the public is not terribly enthused about space, never has been, and never will be. There is a small vocal minority that is intensely enthusiastic about it. What NASA needs to do is to craft a program that fundamentally builds incrementally the capabilities we want under the existing budgetary environment. And I personally think that is possible.
Let's hold it right there for our first break for KKNW in Seattle. And everybody stay where you are. We'll be back with Dr. Spoudis and more on this in about 3 minutes.
The Space Show thanks its listeners for their generous support. The Space Show now joins forces with the One Giant Leap Foundation to further advance space education and the establishment of a spacefaring society and culture in America and the world. One Giant Leap Foundation is a tax-exempt organization with the purpose of advancing space education and development along with The Space Show. Your support of The Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation helps get the word out as to why space is so essential and important to us all. So join with us by going to www.thespaceshow.com and clicking on the Support The Space Show button. Your contribution will help The Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation in continuing its work and bringing you the programming you want free of charge on a continued basis. And remember, your gift to The Space Show is tax deductible.
The mission of The Space Show is to promote future economic opportunities, scientific discoveries, and medical advances for all humankind through peaceful and cooperative ventures in outer space. The Space Show intends to be the forum by which space exploration becomes an integral part of our culture, our economy, our country, our world, and our global vision, in which all nations unite in creating a thriving future through the enormous potentials afforded by off-Earth opportunities. The Space Show is committed to advancing integrity and responsibility, both in our off-Earth conduct and in the potential long-range consequences of our actions in space. The Space Show wants to make the dreams of space today the realities of tomorrow.
Welcome back, everybody. You are listening to The Space Show. I'm your host, David Livingston. Our guest today, Dr. Paul Spoudis. Paul, I want to clarify where we were at the end of the hour, because at the end of the break, because you're really talking about something that is not really well understood, or I'm not sure it is even understood at all. If 50% of Americans are indifferent to space, and the other 50% either don't like it or are enthusiast or whatever, then you're not going to really convert 50% of Americans to be space advocates or space enthusiasts, and they're not going to care one way or another what space does because they're indifferent. So then the question becomes, how do you develop space or the moon or whatever your goal is in the most cost-effective, scientific, engineering, productive, sensible way that you can do without regard to trying to say, we need to inspire, we need to convert, we need to change the world?
Yes, let me slightly rephrase how you put that. I didn't mean to imply that 50% were indifferent and 50% are widely enthusiastic. What the polling data actually show are that 50% sort of approve of it and 50% sort of slightly disapprove of it. So neither feelings are not high on either side. Very few people actually cast a vote for a congressman or a senator on the basis of how that person votes on space. So what I conclude from that is that 50-50 measure of mildly approving or slightly disapproving is a measure of indifference. So my point is the public as a whole are largely indifferent.
Okay.
Now, I don't mean to imply that there's not an avid and active core space cadets, of which I proudly consider myself one. Of course there is, and we live, eat, sleep, and breathe space. But you know, the analogy I make is that we're buffs. We love this stuff. We would read about it and study it even if we didn't have to for our jobs. We just think it's great stuff. But you know, other things have buffs too. Trains, for example. My grandson is a great train fan. He just loves trains. He loves locomotives. He loves model trains. He loves to see trains. And people read books about trains and building trains, and they make switchyards and things. But most of us don't think about trains very much, unless there's an accident, okay? And in a way, I want to make space more like that. Space is just another realm where we have exploratory and economic endeavor, and it's a part of our world. It's an extension of man's reach. And people are never going to be wildly enthusiastic about it. They're never going to get so excited that they drop everything and watch every mission. And of course, Apollo 11 drew a lot of attention because that was a significant historical milestone. It was inevitable that it would draw a lot of attention. But after it was over, people went back to their daily lives. And effectively, that's not a bad thing, because what that really tells us is that since people are doing that, they look at space as just another part of their lives. They're not obsessed with it like we are.
George in Salt Lake City says, many people look to NASA and then blame it because they're not doing a good job of inspiring the youth of America to getting more kids into STEM education and all of that. They claim that we were doing great when Apollo was alive, and then NASA lost its focus, and therefore we have lost the ability to innovate and inspire and motivate kids to study the hard STEM classes. They also cite the engineering deficiencies of American-trained engineers versus Chinese and Indians. I'm wondering, do you think that NASA should be trying to inspire? It sounds like you don't think that that is a mission for NASA.
Well, no. I think when you try to inspire, you typically fail. I think if you do inspiring things, you will inspire. So To give you another example, I mean, even during Apollo, yes, that inspired a lot of people, but that didn't inspire most people. I mean, the vast bulk of the population didn't become scientists and mathematicians and engineers, but a critical core group did, including myself and a lot of my colleagues. And we were excited because we were buffs and we saw the greatest thing we had ever seen in our lives. If you basically create the ability to live, for people to live on the moon and to eventually go to the planets, you'll get all the inspiration you need. You'll basically have a system where the person who is really interested in this stuff can get inspired. So the inspiration thing is important. I don't downplay it. We need a competent technical and scientific infrastructure and base for our country. But I think that if you do the right things, if you start crafting a program that incrementally extends our reach and improves our capabilities, that you'll get that inspiration as a matter of course.
Alan in Dallas, Texas says, Paul, you're a lunar scientist, yet it sounds to me like you're sacrificing your expertise, your interest, your profession, lunar science, for something different, that is trying to figure out a way to be spacefaring and to do things on other worlds as well as the moon. As a lunar science and a scientist in a perfect world, what do you want to learn and do from the moon? And how can your science inquisitive mind couple in and support what you're talking about today?
Well, I don't want anyone to get the wrong idea. I'm not completely altruistic. I have my motives as well. And my attitude is, if we do what I want to do, if we go back to the moon and learn the skills that we need to effectively stay there, to create a sustainable presence there, I'll get all the science I can handle and then some. Of course, given an unlimited free hand and a budget, yes, we could build rockets, and I would be happy to rocket to 55 different sites all around the moon and study them in detail, and that would be great for lunar science as well. But the simple fact is, doing all that from the Earth is prohibitively expensive. It's simply beyond any kind of reasonable expectation. Now, on the other hand, suppose I find the ideal spot on the moon where I'm close to resources and I have a lot of energy and I can generate those capabilities. I can do the same thing that I just described, but stage those missions from the moon, not from the Earth. So by going to the moon, to one place, building up infrastructure, creating capability, I'm automatically giving myself the capability I need to explore the entire moon as a globe. And in the same sense, once you've done that in one place on the moon where you can actually routinely access the points, the lunar surface, going to and from with reusable systems, refueling on the moon, then fundamentally you've got a transportation system that can access not only the moon, but also any other point in cislunar space, any point between the Earth's surface and the moon, which is this volume called cislunar. Now, all of our space assets are in this volume of space. Every GPS system, every communication satellite, every remote sensing platform, even our national security assets are all in the volume of cislunar space. And by creating the ability to routinely go to those points with whatever capability I need, including human repairmen or robotic machines or whatever, then fundamentally I have revolutionized the paradigm of spaceflight. I've changed the way we do space business. We no longer would build one-offs that are launched on expendable rockets, used for a while, and then thrown away. We've actually created a system that literally opens up the space frontier to many different people for many different purposes. So I like to think of this system that we're building to go to the moon as building the transcontinental railroad of space. We're effectively spanning the distance between Earth and moon and all points in between.
What are some of the burning lunar science questions that you and your associates would like to see resolved or answered, if possible?
Well, there's quite a few of them, actually. And in fact, there's a group that I'm part of called the Lunar Exploration Analysis Group that's just completed what they call a roadmap of lunar science. And that is largely a wish list of problems and issues we would like to address. It's 122 pages long.
Is it available?
And we have a summarized on an Excel spreadsheet. It's got several hundred entries. We call it the spreadsheet of death. And it basically covers a variety of scientific questions, such as When did the moon initially form? What was its early history? When did the rocks crystallize? What was the bombardment history of the moon? I mean, there's literally the story of the moon. We only know it in vague outline. And filling in those details, as they say in a lot of fields, the devil is in the details. Once you have a general notion of what happened, that's one thing. But actually understanding that and understanding what it means for the history of the Earth is another thing quite different. So there's a lot to learn on the moon, and a lot of what we learn on the moon is relevant not only to the history of the Earth, but to the history of all the terrestrial planets.
Does this group have a website? Is that document on the web?
They do, and I'll get that for you. I think that it's hosted at the NASA headquarters, but yes, it does have a website, and that roadmap will be posted there for anyone to download and look at.
Okay. You know, this is a fun question, and it's really sort of digressing from what we're talking about, but a very young listener emailed me earlier in the week for my opinion on it, and he said, why do we call our moon the moon? We've given names to every other planet's moons. Why can't we give a name to our moon instead of just calling it the moon? And, you know, I know what the origins of the word moon come from, but why don't we have a name for our moon instead of just moon?
Well, that's a very good question, actually. And you know, I think it's probably because the three things that there were the two things in the sky that don't really have a name in the same sense that the other ones do are the sun and the moon. And both of those are basically words of Germanic origin. All the other planets tend to have names that are derived from Greek or Roman mythology. And so my feeling is that the moon actually does have a name. We just don't use it. It's the name of the moon is Luna. That was the Latin word for the moon. And so Terra and Luna are the name of Earth and Moon. And we just don't call it that because we prefer the English language anyway prefers the Germanic version. But of course, in all the Romance languages like Spanish and French, they do call it Luna. The moon does have a name. We just choose not to use it in English.
Okay. This is from Stephen in Canada. Technically, NASA doesn't build the booster. Major commercial companies do that. NASA offers launch and support services, but they get to set approve whether the booster is safe enough to operate for different types of payloads, manned or unmanned. This is why private companies like SpaceX are able to be formed and grow. NASA also acts like an orbital traffic cop and works with other space agencies to manage or at least try to manage what is happening beyond the atmosphere. Am I mistaken in this view? I know there is a lot more that NASA actually does and wants to do, but given their current budget, is it not likely to happen anytime soon?
Well, it's a little more complicated than that. NASA does a variety of activities. They launch satellites, they launch human missions, they conduct space science, and they conduct a variety of other applications. The debate in lunar return is, should NASA invest its scarce budgetary dollars in the development of a new rocket whose sole purpose is to launch their own astronauts to and from the surface of the Earth? And that's really the debate. Now, the argument for that is that given a certain set of requirements, there are no commercial rockets that can satisfy them. Therefore, NASA has to build the rocket that they need to do the mission. The response to that can be, well, where are your requirements coming from? Why have you constructed an architecture that requires a very large rocket to be built? It's an endless argument. It's chicken and egg. I think the reason NASA wants to build their own booster is because that was their origin. That's they grew out of the Army Ballistic Missile Group in Huntsville. And that was incorporated, Von Braun and his group were incorporated in NASA at a very early stage. And it's part of the NASA culture to want to build a NASA rocket to launch NASA astronauts. The idea of contracting that from a commercial entity bothers them a little bit. Now, there's a middle ground between that, between contracting a commercial entity and building their own, and that is using expendable vehicles that have already been developed on government money, and that would be things like the evolved expendable launch vehicles, the Atlas V and the Delta IV Heavy. Both of those could be adapted to launching astronauts, and for a variety of reasons, NASA chose not to do that. They chose instead to invest their money in building the Ares I. So it's a complicated question. I think the main reason NASA does the things it does is for the simple reason that it's always done it that way. It's an agency that's 50 years old now. They have a distinct culture. They have a set of procedures. They have their own history, their own folklore, their own way of doing things, their template. And they do things the way they do because they've always done them that way.
And yet there is at least a competing ideology here with the Augustine panel to consider whether to use the ELVs over Ares I, for example. Do you think there's a chance that that might be the way they go?
That there is definitely a chance that might be the way they go. I don't want to second guess them. I don't know what they're going to conclude, but I certainly sense that given the technical problems that Ares I has had, that as a program, I sense that it is in some degree of trouble.
If you sit down, and I guess there's so many departments within NASA in charge of returning to the moon, it would be hard to sit down and poll them. But if you could poll only those people within NASA who are really directly associated with going to the moon, where do you think they'd come out in terms of what we've been discussing today in the mission statement that you proposed at the end of the last segment?
You mean would they be for it or against it?
Yeah, would they be for or against it?
I suspect most of them would be against it, and I suspect that largely because that's something they don't know, and they're not sure that it's possible. And my response to them is, well, it's your job to find out if it is possible or not. But remember, this impetus to change the vision into something it was never intended to be, to basically make the vision an Apollo to Mars kind of program, that started before Mike Griffin became administrator. That started the moment the thing was announced. I remember hearing very distinctly, we had a briefing very early in the Aldrich Commission. It was literally a month after the vision was announced. And we got a briefing from a NASA associate administrator who fundamentally told us that the Mars part of the program was driven by science objectives and the moon part of the program was driven by the needs for Mars. And effectively eliminating completely, one, any lunar science, two, any lunar habitation theme, and three, any use of in-situ lunar resources. And that was in direct contradistinction to what the vision directed NASA to do. Now, that occurred 1 month after it was announced. And so, effectively, there are people in NASA who have been fighting the very idea of the vision from day one. Now, having said that, there are a lot of people at NASA who I have worked with in the last few years who have tried their best to implement the vision as it was originally intended. They just haven't succeeded. They've been outvoted and outcommanded.
And no way to have a feeling of how NASA's going to react under new leadership.
No, but my suspicion is that for the rank and file, things won't change very much. When you try to bring in, you try to fundamentally change the way an agency does something, you're going to get resistance. And it really takes not only a dynamic leadership, a dynamic leader to change things, but he has to be a little bit careful, too. He can't just go in like a bull in a china shop and announce that things are going to be completely different and fire people left and right. You can't do that with a federal agency. You've got to very carefully torque things in first a slightly different direction. Then, if you're successful, then a slightly more different direction. And it's something that has to be evolved over a long period of time. It's extremely difficult. I don't minimize the difficulty for a minute. Whether they can actually pull it off, that's something I really don't know.
Tim in Albuquerque says, from your experience, what kind of message resonates most with Congress? This is key, since Congress is who funds NASA.
Well, Congress is, you know, in contrast to what a lot of people think, yes, there's the pork barreling and there's the log rolling, But I think fundamentally they want to do the right thing. They support space for what they think are very patriotic reasons. They think that it's important that America is a technological leader. They think space, the space program is an expression of that, and they want to do the right thing. They want to support NASA to basically create high technology that America can use for a variety of purposes. Now, that said, they tend to respond to two kinds of appeals. There is the purely personal base appeal, which is, well, look, you've got 40,000 aerospace workers in your district, and unless you vote for this, they're going to go out and campaign for your opponent next time. And that's very effective because that gets politicians' attention. But the other thing is to appeal to them is to basically present them with a logical argument. And I've done this on several occasions. I've testified before both the Senate and the House. I've tried to make the argument I'm making on your program, basically saying that here's why we're going to the moon, here's what we'll do there, here's what it'll give us. And I find they're very responsive to that. They're very receptive. They think that's an interesting and a neat idea. They haven't really thought of it in those terms before. So, in actual fact, there's good and bad in Congress, like there's good and bad in all of this. I think that they want to do the right thing. Sometimes they get different opinions from different people. It's hard for them to sort out what the right thing is.
You know, that is for sure. Do you think that the other countries that want to go to the moon, and we're constantly hearing China will go to the moon before us, or India, or Russia, if any of these countries actually do go to the moon, and I'm kind of skeptical, but let's assume they actually do go to the moon, are they doing flags and footprints, or are they doing anything at all along the lines that you've been recommending and talking about today?
Well, it remains to be seen. Yeah, my sense is that their initial motivations, in any event, is very much a nationalistic flags and footprints kind of mode of operation. And it's largely driven, I think, by their desire to be taken seriously as a first world, first rank group of nations. So I think that's a big driving factor in some of the international exploration. But the simple fact is that's kind of irrelevant to what we're trying to do. We have already had a space program based on nationalistic geopolitics. And it worked. It was great. In fact, I would argue that in many ways, beating the Soviets to the moon actually materially contributed to the American victory in the Cold War. But with that done, there was no rationale to continue that kind of space program. Effectively, we had to transition from a space program with those kinds of goals to one whose goals were more subtle. And there's been a constant tension ever since then between sort of the three paradigms, the Saganite one, which holds that space is primarily a place for scientific exploration, the von Braunian one, which holds that space is a place where we accomplish great national goals for reasons of world prestige, and then the new one that's never been tried, and the one that I think the vision is all about, is the O'Neillian paradigm, which is effectively dealing with space settlement and learning how to use the resources of space to create new capability. Now, that was the intent of the vision, to actually move the center of gravity of our program slightly in that direction. We haven't yet succeeded in doing that, but I think that's an admirable objective.
Is any other nation capable of doing that, or would we be the only ones in our space program capable of doing that?
Well, the science and technology of resource utilization is available to anyone who cares to try to use it. Certainly, I've made this argument. I'm involved with the Indian mission, the Chandrayaan 1 mission, which is currently orbiting the moon right now. I've made this argument to the Indians, to the Indian Space Research Organization, and they fully understand it. They understand exactly what the leveraging possibilities are. So it's no idea that the United States can claim unique possession of. Anyone who wants to go and do that on the moon is certainly welcome to try it.
Why does the Indian Space Agency seem to get what you're saying, and there's so much trouble in getting NASA to hear what you're saying?
Well, keep in mind, they've heard what I've said. I didn't say they've necessarily bought into it yet. But what I'm saying, what the point I was trying to make is that they understand it. And I think NASA understands it too, at least intellectually. I think, like I said, I think they're afraid of it. They're afraid of what it might mean.
Really interesting. It seems like if we make the wrong decision, it's going to have decades of adverse impact on space development. It's not going to be easy to reverse. Is that a fair assessment?
Well, we've had decades that have been detrimental to our abilities in space.
Well, we may have more.
We may have more. That's an entirely possible outcome. I don't deny that for a minute. But I'm not going to go quietly into that good night. I mean, if we don't do this, then at least they're going to hear me kicking and screaming in the background.
Are you the only one kicking and screaming, or do you have others that are voicing pretty much the same thing you said?
No, I think there are others. I just wrote a paper with Dennis Wingo and Gordon Woodcock that Keith Cowing actually published on his website, and it's called Changing the Status Quo in Space, that largely argues for exactly what we've just been talking about. So it's I'm not the only one who believes this. There's a lot of us actually around.
Okay. We're going to break for KKNW at the top of the hour in Seattle. So those of you listening, you can hear the rest of this show on archives, or you can, if you're near your computer and you're not driving your car, you can switch over and hear the rest of it at thespaceshow.com. And for everybody else, stay right where you are, and we'll be back with the remaining two segments of this show in about 2 minutes.
The Space Show thanks its listeners for their generous support. The Space Show now joins forces with the One Giant Leap Foundation to further advance space education and the establishment of a spacefaring society and culture in America and the world. One Giant Leap Foundation is a tax-exempt organization with the purpose of advancing space education and development along with The Space Show. Your support of The Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation helps get the word out as to why space is so essential and important to us all. So join with us by going to www.thespaceshow.com and clicking on the Support The Space Show button. Your contribution will help The Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation in continuing its work and bringing you the programming you want free of charge on a continued basis. And remember, your gift to The Space Show is tax deductible.
I'm Dr. David Livingston, creator and host of The Space Show, and I would like to share my vision with you for not only this radio program, but for space development. Space should be like any other place we choose to visit, work in, or call our home. It should be just another destination, like Tahiti, Hawaii, or any place available to us right now on Earth. When this vision becomes reality, we will be spacefaring in our culture, our economy, our society, and in our lives. Our world will be vastly improved by countless space-related benefits, transforming our lives both in space and right here on Earth. And The Space Show is helping to make this vision a global reality.
Welcome back, everybody. You are listening to The Space Show. And our guest today, Dr. Paul Spoudas. So, Paul, you told me during the break you have some radar experiments on ongoing missions right now. You want to tell us a little about your experiments?
Yeah, I would. But before I get into that, let me comment on your mission statement that
okay.
You just played. This is literally exactly what I'm trying to say in regard to getting people excited about space and the irrelevance of that. Effectively, what you said there in that statement is space should be a destination just like any place else.
Absolutely.
For example, I think you mentioned Tahiti.
Right.
Now, do we get people excited about people going to Tahiti? Well, not really, because anyone can do it. And in the same token, you want to start building a system in space where anyone can go anywhere they want for whatever purpose they want. So that's my objective. And what I'm trying to do is to get NASA to see that their job is to enable that kind of future, not to create it, but to enable it. And so their first task is to go back to the moon and learn how to use what we find on the moon to create that kind of capability. I just wanted to make that point before we go into the other.
You know, even going to Mount Everest is pretty routine. We're interested. We see documentaries on it all the time, and we like to hear the adventure stories of people who have been able to go there and climb it because it's a little bit different. The same with going to Antarctica, but we're not focused on it, and it's a routine part of our life is to have a little bit of unusual travel, a little bit of routine travel, and adventure.
And some people are excited about it, but some people aren't, and
right.
That's okay. I mean, it's all right for that to happen.
You know, absolutely. Some people go to football games every single weekend that they can go because that's what they live for. You know, it's just the routine way we live our lives. And for space to really work for us, it has to be routine like that. And it can't be this special destination requiring so damn much political and every other kind of energy to do every little thing possible to get there, let alone whatever it is we're going to do when we are there.
Exactly. And what we're trying to do, what I want to do, is to try to ease that transition from that mode of operation, which is our current situation, to one in which it's much more routine and unremarkable. Now, having said that, you asked me about the radar experiment.
Right.
I have two instruments aboard two spacecraft that are orbiting the moon right now. Back last October, there was a launch of the Indian Chandrayaan 1 mission, which was launched from India. This is India's first mission to the moon. I proposed several years ago to fly an imaging radar on that mission, and that proposal was accepted. And we've been orbiting the moon for about the last 7-8 months. We've had our first mapping cycle. We got 2 months out of that time to map both poles of the moon. Spectacular data. It really looks good. For the first time, we can look down into the very bottoms of the darkest permanently shadowed areas near the poles of the moon. And what we're looking for is the telltale signature for the presence of water ice there. Now, we've conducted our first mapping cycle. We have a bunch of excellent data, very high quality. I've just written up and submitted for publication the team's first science report. And it's in review in Science right now. It should if things go well, it should appear within the next month or two. I think the results are going to be very interesting for people. I can't talk about them because Science has a policy about not talking about results until a paper is actually published. But we have excellent quality data, and I'm looking forward to that.
Who built the hardware? Was that built in India?
No, this is an American instrument. It was NASA funded it. The Office of Space Operations funded it as part of their communications division, because it's fundamentally imaging radar is a communications technical issue. The instrument was built by Raytheon under contract to the U.S. Navy. So we actually worked with the Navy. This was an outgrowth of an experiment we did using the radio transmitter and receiver of the Clementine mission back in 1994. Clementine didn't carry a radar instrument, but it carried a radio transmitter that was used for data downlink, and we improvised an experiment where we beamed radio into the poles of the moon and listened to the echoes on the deep space network. And from that work, we got the first indication that something interesting was going on in those dark areas. So ever since that mission, we've been trying to find a mission that would fly a small, lightweight imaging radar based on that principle. And we proposed it to the Indians in 2004, and they accepted it, and we're orbiting the moon right now.
Did you have to go through ITAR with any of this?
I did indeed, and that was an experience I personally don't care to repeat. I learned more about the legalities of international technology transfer in 1 year than I ever had hoped to know. However, I will say this. Everyone who I worked with at State and at APL, I was at the Applied Physics Lab at that time, they were very helpful in helping us trying to get this through the system. It took a year, but we did get approval, so I can't really complain too much about it. Yes, it was an effort, but I just look upon it as part of the overhead of the project.
Even with NASA involved and the Navy involved, you still had to, you know, march to every bell and whistle.
Well, especially with the Navy involved, because then it becomes a question of is there possible military technology that can be transferred. And however, it turns out that at the last minute, there were a couple of snags, but they weren't on our side. They were on the Indian side, and they were resolved quickly. The administrator, Mike Griffin, went over and met his counterpart, Dr. Nair, over in India, and they both agreed to fly the experiment.
Cool. What's the second radar experiment?
Second radar is a more advanced version of the one that's flying on Chandrayaan, and it is flying on the American Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter right now. We've already turned it on. We turned it on a couple of weeks ago. We got our first data strips. It's different from the Indian radar in two ways. One is it has two frequencies rather than one. The radar on the Indian spacecraft is S-band, that the wavelength is 13 centimeters. The radar on the LRO spacecraft is both S-band, 13 centimeter, and X-band, which is about 5 centimeters. So in a way, it's a multispectral radar, if you will. It has two frequencies rather than one. The advantage of that is that you can look at two different scales of surface roughness or backscatter. The second advantage of this instrument over the Indian one is that it has a nominal mode of 75-meter resolution, just like the Indian radar, but in addition, it has a high-resolution mode of about 15 meters. So we can see the dark areas of the moon in unprecedented detail with these instruments. And finally, the really exciting thing about having two radars at once in lunar orbit is it's possible to design an experiment where both radars operate simultaneously to do something called bistatic imaging. And what that means is that you transmit with one instrument and you receive with the other. The advantage of that is that when you do that, you're looking at echoes that are being reflected off the moon at an angle other than zero. Basically, a monostatic radar sends a pulse from its antenna, it bounces off the moon, it comes back. You're looking at the moon in the same phase, the same incidence angle as you receive it. If you have a bistatic experiment, you can look at a different angle. And the significance of that is that ice has a very unique bistatic response. So we're hopeful to conduct that experiment sometime in the month of August.
Are the two in close approximate orbit, or where do they have to be positioned to be able to do that experiment?
To do that experiment, they do have to be very close. And it turns out that right now, the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter, which just arrived at the moon at the end of June, is in a commissioning orbit of about 30 kilometers over the South Pole and 200 kilometers over the North Pole. Chandrayaan is in a 200-kilometer circular orbit. So there are certain times when both spacecraft are close to each other, both over the North Pole area at the same time. So that is likely where we'll conduct this bistatic experiment.
So when their orbits sort of interconnect, that's where you're able to do it.
That's right. And we had an excellent opportunity yesterday that unfortunately we missed. We came within 4 kilometers of each other, which is really close in space. It made some people a bit nervous, in fact. But what we're doing right now is looking at the orbits and the timing of each spacecraft, and we're trying to figure out when that next close encounter will be and then plan for our bistatic experiment at that time.
Do you have students working on this, or what's the profile of the typical person, you know, doing this type of analysis and working on this project?
Well, on the Indian radar, which is called MINISAR, which stands for Miniature Synthetic Aperture Radar, we have a science team of about 10 working scientists, all people of a variety of expertise. I would say about half of us are radio astronomy experts, and then the other half are lunar scientists. I'm definitely in the latter camp. I have no expertise in radar, but I am interested in the moon. So we've created a team that has experts in both. And then there are a bunch of postdocs that at all these other institutions and at APL, which is where this project was started, that are actually helping us command the spacecraft and downlinking the data and then doing the initial data processing. So I would imagine that there's a group of probably about 25 to 30 people involved all told in both experiments in aggregate.
I'm pretty amazing that you can do this. You know, the LRO sent back pictures of the Apollo landing sites,
yeah,
you know, in celebration for the 40th anniversary of the moon. Do you personally ever run into people who tell you we never went to the moon and who disbelieve everything? Does that ever happen to you?
It, It does on rare occasion. Every now and then I'll run into someone who bounces that off of me. I had a really interesting experience a few years ago. I have a good friend of mine is a high school chemistry teacher, and back in Lexington, Kentucky. And she actually asked me if I would come and talk to her students, because a lot of her students didn't believe that we actually landed on the moon. So what I did was I had a videotape of that infamous special that was on a few years ago
on Fox or whatever
Fox,
it was, yeah.
It was about, you know, the landing was a big hoax. And I took that videotape, and what I did in that class was to run the tape, and after each allegation, I stopped the tape and I said, okay, well, let's talk about this a little bit. And I just had a dialogue with the students. I didn't lecture them. I didn't tell them that they were believing stupid stuff. I just asked them, you know, why would they say this? Why would you think this? And I let them reason it out for themselves. And that was actually extremely effective. They thought about it. They tried to reason for themselves why certain claims may or may not have validity. And I thought it was very successful. And I had a lot of fun to boot.
Well, they sure came out of the woodwork for Apollo 11, and the news media sure gave them a lot of press time, which I thought was pretty unfortunate. Although I guess they thought it would help sell and push ratings. I can't think of any other reason to do it.
Yeah, that's pretty much their reasoning. That's what they're in business for.
So, but then you know, I've read articles by different people. There was a University of Maryland scientist who made a total ass of himself on the Stephen Colbert show. I don't know if you know that gentleman or not.
I think I can guess who it might be.
Who do you guess?
I'd rather not say.
Well, I'll say it was a Dr. Park. I don't remember his first name. And unfortunately for him, man, you don't want to go one-on-one against Colbert because, you know, he talks over you, he interrupts, he twists everything you say. You know, he's there to make a joke out of whatever your position is. It wouldn't have mattered whether he thought, you know, going to the moon was the best thing in the world. He would have made a joke out of that, too. So, you know, Park was not equipped to go one-on-one against someone like Colbert. So this is one of the guys you don't agree to go on the show with, as far as I'm concerned. But Whoopi Goldberg sounded off. I don't know if you heard that little cut or not.
I heard about it.
She thinks we didn't go to the moon because the flag is moving. And how could the flag move? And then Barbara Walters.
That was on the Fox thing as well, and that came up in the class I was in.
Of course.
And I explained to him, I said, you know, when watch the tape, when the astronauts move away from the flag, it stops moving. And I explained to them how they had wires embedded in the cloth to make the thing stand out so it wouldn't hang limply on the moon. And, you know, the thing is, sometimes people will say something, and it sounds like they have the air of authority. You know, he must know what he's talking about. And the simple fact is that critical thinking is a skill that's rapidly
declining
in American society
today. What was funny with that is Barbara Walters decided to challenge Whoopi. So she knows nothing about the space program. And she says, oh, they're telling me in my ear that we had 6 missions to the moon. I thought that was really great. She didn't even know that on her own. They're telling me. And you know, it wouldn't be possible for all 6 to lie and cover up. I mean, that was her argument. You know, back to Whoopi, and I'm thinking, you know, my God. Well, first of all, who's watching The View anyway? But
was. It's interesting because think about it. You can say, well, Barbara Walters doesn't know that there were only 6 landings on the moon. Why should she know that? You know, here's what I'm getting at from the earlier segment. We are buffs. We love this stuff. We know who the crews of all the Apollo missions were. We know where they went. We know how they were launched. We know all the little anomalies that occurred on their flights because we love this stuff. But the average person doesn't know anything about it, doesn't worry about not knowing anything about it. They think in general it's a good idea, but they're not consumed by it. So that's actually a fairly good illustration of that very effect right there.
Well, but in terms of our knowing, you know, American and world history and important events, is knowing that we went to the moon 6 times a relevant thing to know, or is it just that we know we went to the moon?
I would say the latter.
You know,
I mean, when you talk about history, people's knowledge of it is strongly colored by their interests. If you're interested in military history, then you know the details of every unit and regiment and every battle of the Civil War. If you're not interested in that, you may be interested in something else. Maybe you're interested in social history, so you know about strange movements that have happened throughout American history. And that's exactly my point. If you're interested in this stuff, you're a buff, and it's great. If you're not, it doesn't mean you're necessarily bad or stupid or evil. It just means that you don't particularly care about it.
And that falls into that poll survey that you talked about earlier on, about who's indifferent, and it's either side of the coin. It's about the same thing.
Yeah, and there's not real strong feeling either way, and that's what struck me, is that it's they're not, you know, 50% dead set against going into space and 50% wildly enthusiastic. It's 50%, yeah, I guess so, versus 50%, nah, not really.
But then there are people who really don't know history and who opine about this stuff with all sorts of really erroneous facts like this. One person wrote an article in the San Francisco Examiner, a rabbi, and how the Saturn V caused all sorts of nuclear rockets and warheads to be orbiting Earth and, you know, going into missiles and launching wars. And
I'm familiar with that piece, and you're right. I mean, you're going to have the fringe set of you're always going to have that fringe.
So you got
part of the price we pay for living in a free society, I think.
So you got to see all of it then. You've seen all of these pieces.
Oh, I've had quite an entertaining last couple of weeks. I knew that the Apollo anniversary was going to be an orgy of self-congratulation. But I guess I there are very few pieces that I saw, there were a few exceptions, that really got the true significance of Apollo. And most people were trying to say, well, we went to the moon once, why can't we go to the moon again? Why did we turn away from the promise of space that Apollo gave us? And what I try to tell people like that is, well, wait a minute. Apollo had nothing to do with space. Apollo was a battle in a war. It was a battle in the Cold War. And that's it. You want to know why we went and stopped going to the moon? Because when you win a battle, you don't keep fighting it. So Apollo didn't really have anything to do with spacefaring per se. It just happened
to be the space. It was a battlefield to win the Cold War.
Exactly, and yeah, I'm reminded of this great line in one of the Star Trek movies where the Enterprise crew goes back in time, and some woman is talking to Kirk and says, "You know, the next thing you know, you'll be telling me you're from outer space." And Kirk says, "Well," in response, says, "No, actually, I'm from Iowa. I just work in outer space." And it's the same way with Apollo. All right, actually, it wasn't about space at all. It just happened to have occurred on the moon.
Did you by chance attend the New Space Gala dinner the last night of the conference?
I did not.
Because the other side of this was they showed a trailer for a film, and I forget the name of it. And, you know, this person interviewed all different reporters who supposedly covered Apollo, and every single one of them was telling about how bad Apollo was and how horrible it was for our future and education. And, you know, I mean, when it ended, Tomlinson was so inspired, he grabbed the microphone and said, "This is the kind of mindset we have to fight, we have to contest, we can never allow these kind of attitudes to prevail." One of the crusty old reporters even blamed some of this on the Bush administration, which I thought was pretty interesting.
Well, it hasn't been blamed on
Bush. You know, someone whispered in my ear that said when we went to the moon, Bush was probably doing lines of coke or drunk driving. So, but yeah, they all seem to have come out of the woodwork. One of the networks even interviewed the guy that Buzz punched out.
Look, there's always, like you say, they want to go for a sensational story, something that's amusing, something that's attractive. There's very little thoughtful analysis anymore in the news. It's all about product.
Well, but I guess the problem is what you said earlier is we seem to have lost so much of our ability to do critical thinking and discernment that we easily buy into this stuff if we see it on national TV or someone that we tend to think is a hero figure for whatever reason is interviewing the person, like Stephen Colbert, for example.
Right.
So, but you should go on his show. That would be a fun discussion because you're a pretty funny guy. You might be able to keep up with the guy, but I think they only put people on that they can easily manhandle. I'm not sure of that. Do you think we are, if the Let's Go to Mars camp were to prevail, and Augustine's panel and this, government look at the entire breadth of the space program from DOD to DARPA to NASA and everything that's going on. If they somehow came back and said, okay, we're going straight to Mars because we need to inspire millions of new students, whatever, you've heard of it. Are we, engineering-wise, scientifically-wise, medically, are we prepared to even design a Mars mission? Are we well enough along in our capabilities that we could do it? Or would we still be looking at a 20 or 30-year timetable because we need to learn to crawl and walk and inch along before we could do something like that?
I think it's worse than that. I think what you would get is 30 years of UGRAF making. I don't even think you would get to Mars after 30 years. If effectively, and my evidence for that is we've been trying to go to Mars for the last 30 years. I mean, right after Apollo 11 launched, there was a Vice President Agnew at the time was given the order from Nixon to create a space task group and write a report and to recommend what should future goals be in space for America. And they came back with a report, and it said manned mission to Mars. And that was put on the shelf. Then we had the Ride report in the late 80s, followed by the first Augustine report in the early 90s, and both of those said that there should be a manned Mars mission. And both of those were put on the shelf. Then we had SEI, and we had the Stafford Synthesis Group that I was part of, and that looked at doing a manned Mars mission, and that was put on the shelf. Now, in 2004, we've had the Vision for Space Exploration, which didn't say a manned Mars mission, but that's the way NASA interpreted it. And look at what they've done in 5 years. They haven't even gotten a working prototype of the first vehicle that they were supposed to build as part of this initiative. So the simple fact is that if we go this route, go down this road once again, we're going to end up with another series of decades of no progress, no activity, but a lot of really spectacular graphics.
Okay, so let's this time hypothetically fund our mission to Mars, and starting in the next appropriation, NASA's budget is tripled, and all of that money is earmarked to a manned to Mars or human to Mars mission.
You'll get triple the UGRAF.
So you're saying you can't shorten the learning curve by pouring a ton of money into it?
And my evidence is that we haven't.
Well,
it used to be said that it will give us the direction and we can do it, but the simple fact is that I don't think they've shown that they can do it. I know what you're getting at. You want to know is that technically are we ready to go to Mars right now?
Well, yeah,
I think the answer to that question is that no, we're not. But the fact is the people who believe that we are won't be convinced otherwise by any logical argument. They passionately believe that we are, that the people who want to go to the moon are the ones that are in their way to accomplishing their childhood dreams. I recall sitting in a briefing at NASA headquarters. This was the Exploration Systems Division, and getting a big harangue from a senior NASA official. I won't name who it was, but it ended with him saying, I want to see a human mission to Mars in my lifetime. And I looked around, and I said, well, wait a minute, where did that requirement come from? I didn't hear that in the presidential directive. I didn't see it in the vision policy document. And so his attitude was, we will suborn anything that we have to do on the moon solely for the goal of making sure that we have a manned Mars mission in his lifetime. Now, that's the kind of mindset you're dealing with.
I can elaborate on that. But you know, most people say if we only had the right funding, we could do this. So what you're saying is even if you had double or triple the funding, you can't buy down the learning curve substantially to do a human to Mars mission.
That is what I believe.
I have.
And I haven't seen any evidence that I'm wrong.
I have a couple of listeners that are in Sweden and in Scandinavia, and I love them dearly, and they're really great listeners. But one of them sent me a note about we have to go back to the moon. He wasn't alive the first time we went to the moon, and he's tired of just looking at it on film clips. He wants to be able to see it live on television. So I said, so you want the U.S. taxpayer to fund your adventure because you weren't alive? alive when we went to the moon the first time, right? Why don't you go get your country to fund the damn mission for your own amusement and excitement rather than the U.S. taxpayer to fund it? Of course, there is no reply to that, but that's similar to the guy with the Mars mission. But that is a prevailing attitude. I wasn't around the first time, and most people around today weren't around when we went to the moon, and it's now their turn. They want to see it for real.
And it's all part of the entitlement mindset. You know, I deserve this, so why aren't we doing it?
Well, that's probably not going to change, no matter how many bully pulps.
Well, I'll tell you what else is not going to change, and that is the willingness of Congress to double or triple NASA's budget.
Not going to happen.
Not going to happen. So answer me this: if that, given that that's true, or just assume for the sake of argument that it is true, if NASA cannot devise an affordable architecture under the existing budgetary envelope to go to the moon, something that we allegedly have quote already done, then how in hell are you going to be able to go to Mars under that kind of budgetary envelope?
Why do you want to clutter things up with facts? I mean, you know, this is just not relevant in the mindset of the people, you know, that think we should be able to go do this right away. I mean,
you're absolutely right, and that's sort of what I'm getting at. And that is that the fact, this belief is fundamentally a non-rational one. It's a religious argument. It's no longer a technical one.
Well, I know that I when Bob Zubrin has been on the show, and he's a great friend, and he comes on frequently, and I've said, if we started today, when would we be able to launch to Mars? And, the answer is always 10 years. We could have all the technology, human factors, everything, you know, resolved, ready to go hardware 10 years from today if we started the mission today.
Yeah, right.
And I don't see it, given the way we're able to not develop things. And, you know, if you say we're going to do it all as a totally private mission, give me the private company that has the capability to do any of this, let alone the R&D that would be needed, let alone any of the human factor stuff.
I assume that Bob's going with the 10-year figure largely on the following reasoning: that we went to the moon in 8 years, and the technological gap between what we had then and the lunar surface was much greater than the technological gap between what we have now and humans on Mars.
Yeah,
and I'm sure that's his calculus.
Yeah, that.
What one thing that overlooks is that this is a different country than it was 50 years ago. 50 years ago, we had a very large, diversified, technical, industrial infrastructure. We had that to support the Cold War that we were waging with the Soviet Union. Large amounts of money were spent on defense projects, on high tech, all of it in the name of national security, that created an incredibly diverse, resilient, innovative, responsive infrastructure that we could call on to develop the technologies that we didn't have then. We're in a very different situation now. There aren't nearly as many aerospace companies to call on anymore. The technology is advanced, but it's not that advanced. Some things still take good old chemical rocket propellant burning at a 0.95 mass fraction to get things into low Earth orbit. That's not changed. So to do a Mars mission by staging the mission from the Earth, literally for a chemical or even a nuclear thermal Mars spacecraft, you're talking about roughly 1 million pounds in low Earth orbit. Now, at $20,000 a pound, how much do you figure that's going to cost? And even if it was a smart thing to do, which I don't think it is, I don't even know if we have the technical infrastructure to support a program like that anymore.
Well, if we do, where is it hiding?
Well, we don't. A lot of it was dismantled after the Cold War. A lot of people went into the tech sector, the information age infrastructure, and we don't have those technologies and those companies to call on anymore.
We need to take our break and come back with our final segment. Everybody stay where you are. Back in 2 minutes.
The Space Show thanks its listeners for their generous support. The Space Show now joins forces with the One Giant Leap Foundation to further advance space education and the establishment of a spacefaring society and culture in America and the world. One Giant Leap Foundation is a tax-exempt organization with the purpose of advancing space education and development along with the Space Show. Your support of the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation helps get the word out as to why space is so essential and important to us all. So join with us by going to www.thespaceshow.com and clicking on the Support the Space Show button. Your contribution will help the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation in continuing its work and bringing you the programming you want free of charge on a continued basis. And remember, your gift to the Space Show is tax deductible.
Welcome back, everybody. You're listening to the Space Show today. This is our final segment. Our guest today, Dr. Paul Spoutis. Paul, just at the tail end of the other section when we were talking about Mars, the issue of risk came up. So, you know, there's no doubt that as a nation and also NASA, which probably just reflects the nation rather than serves as a leading indicator on this, we're pretty risk averse. So how do you assess our willingness to accept the risk of actually sending astronauts to the moon rather than just talking about it and going through the motions?
Well, that's a very good question and a very good point. And I, admittedly, if you look at the situation as it now exists, you'd be inclined to say that we're so risk averse that we probably even wouldn't even do that. Certainly during the architecture debates that we had at NASA, and I was part of that, I was involved in some of those, issues of coming up that actually were put to bed 40 years ago when we went to the moon. A great one is the idea that the moon's dust is so reduced that when you bring it back into a cabin and repressurize it 100% oxygen, that you would burst into flames. That was called pyrotoxicity or something like that. And, you know, that was pretty well put the lie to by the Apollo experience, because the LEM didn't burst into flames when it was repressurized. And yet, there's very similar concerns now about lunar dust. They say, well, we don't know how lunar dust behaves, really. We think it's levitated. We think it might stick to things, and electrostatic discharge will cause problems. And all that, I think, is a symptom of largely a loss of nerve, of an unwillingness to at least take not unnecessary risks, but at least reasonable risks based on what you already know. So that's very much a concern, and I think you're right. I do think that there is an issue with the risk aversion that NASA currently has as a feature of its culture.
Ted in Chicago sent in this note and says, earlier in the show you were talking about how actually NASA might not be that interested in even doing the moon mission. I'm wondering, do you think Ares 1, which is reported to be a really horrible rocket, could be a product of a culture or a consciousness that really doesn't want to go back to the moon? The way to stop us from going back to the moon is to build a crap rocket that won't work no matter what they do. Is that a possibility, and could that kind of consciousness and behavior be at play even if it's not obvious?
In all honesty, no, I don't think that. I think that Mike Griffin and Scott Horowitz, who basically came up with this idea of the stick, the Ares 1 rocket, honestly thought this was a good way, a quick way, and a safe way to use shuttle-derived parts to make a rocket that would get people to orbit easily. I think they honestly believed that. In addition, I also think the reason they insisted upon it was that the two parts of the Ares 1, the SRB first stage and the liquid oxygen hydrogen J2 second stage, are piece parts that you need for the big rocket, the Ares 5 later on. So by building this vehicle, Griffin was actually laying in the groundwork to build the big rocket, which is what he really wanted to do. I mean, given his druthers, he'd have liked to have had a doubled budget and go on and build the Ares 5, which is bigger than the Saturn V and can lift 150 metric tons to low Earth orbit, and that's his dream rocket. That's what he wanted to build. But what he did was he came up with the Ares 1 as an intermediate step that would give him the piece parts he needed to build the big rocket, and at the same time solve his immediate problem of a shuttle replacement vehicle that could get astronauts to and from the station. So all the problems with Ares 1, I think, were not anticipated. I don't think it was a deliberate sabotage policy of avoiding the mission on the moon. I think it was an idea that they became so wedded to, they were convinced it was the right idea, that they wouldn't listen to any alternatives.
This is a question from Ben in Tucson, Arizona. And he says, is there any way that the American public can play a role in reversing the risk aversion that seems to permeate our culture and NASA?
I don't know. It's one thing to talk about that, to say and recognize it as a problem. Yes, we've become very risk averse. Getting out of that mindset is very difficult. And I think as a society, we're increasingly more litigious. We're increasingly more cautious. We tend to second guess every decision we make. And all of that is symptomatic, I think, of a general loss of nerve. It's one thing to be obnoxiously overconfident. It's another thing to completely lose your confidence altogether. And I think that I don't see any easy way to back away from that kind of mindset.
Does this mindset exist in other nations' space programs?
To an extent. I mean, it's after all, when every time you make a launch, you're risking multiple millions of dollars, and someone has to make that call. Someone has to decide, yes, we're going, and you don't want to make a bad call. There's kudos for making the right call, but there's sometimes dire consequences for making a bad one. So there's risk aversion in all cultures. It's present in different degrees and to a different extent, I think, in some foreign countries, partly because in most cases the stakes aren't as high as they are for us. So, for example, if Chandrayaan 1 had gone in the Indian Ocean, nobody would have lost their life. Somebody just would have lost a lot of money and a lot of time. So that's a different decision than deciding whether I'm going to launch three guys and hope that they make it. So that's sort of a different level of gut check there.
This is an interesting question. This is Bob, and Bob is also in Albuquerque, New Mexico. He says a lot of people promote and push for space solar power, but there are some that say it would be much cheaper and it would only be cost effective if we were able to build it from the moon or have it emanate from the moon. As a lunar scientist, what do you think about using the moon in any way to support or contribute or produce space solar power?
I think it is entirely possible. And there's sort of two lines to that. There's the line of constructing solar farms, arrays of solar farms on the moon, and then beaming the power from there. The other is to launch the raw material that you need to make solar arrays from the moon and build the arrays in some place closer to the Earth where you have continuous sunlight and you have less path loss of beaming the energy down to the Earth. I tend to favor the latter. I think that's probably the easiest way to do that. But to really make that effective, you're going to need many square kilometers of solar arrays, and that's going to require a lot of mass launched from the moon. My suspicion is that it will only come in a fairly advanced lunar installation when you're actually able to build a mass driver and literally hurl these things off the moon and import them down to lower Earth orbit where your solar satellites will be built.
Would this be robotically done from the moon, or would we need to have people up there?
I think it would be mostly robotically done, but certainly you would need some people to supervise the robotics and to fix things when they break down. I think this dichotomy between humans and robotic flight is somewhat artificial. Tasks require different approaches. Some require machines or are best done with machines. Some are best done with people. So I think you really need both. And, you know, machines break down and need to be fixed. And sometimes there are just jobs that are too big and too onerous for a man to do. So I think you need a combination of the two.
If we were launching our lunar human mission today, how long would it take before we were equipped to be able to do something like use the resources and get them off the moon to someplace else in orbit to build space solar power products. Are we talking about a giant learning curve here, or once we're able to launch humans to the moon, have we overcome most of that learning curve?
Well, that's an interesting question. It sort of revolves around what's your preferred architecture for going back to the moon, which is a very good question, because given that the assumption of the vision was that you would do all this under a constant budget envelope, what that tells me is that you're not going to take giant leaps quickly, that your program needs to be structured so that you're taking small incremental steps that build upon each other. So what I would do is I would craft a program that incrementally begins to emplace what we need on the moon with robotic missions that occur from now until people return to the moon, which may be as soon as 10 years or so. But the first thing you can do is you can launch a series of robotic missions to promising areas. I happen to think the poles are the most interesting for a variety of reasons, not only for the possible volatiles that you find there, but also for the fact that you have areas of near constant sunlight near the poles as well. I would send robotic missions to scout these areas, to map the prospects, to see what the concentration of the volatile material is, where does it occur, what's its physical state. Then I would launch a series of small robotic missions to experiment with extracting useful product out of that, basically extracting water, making oxygen, extracting hydrogen, storing it. You can basically involve a series of tasks that gradually give you the information that allows you to make intelligent decisions. Yes, we're going to go with this process. No, we're going to not use this one. Yes, we're going to store stuff in this way. And the next step is to send slightly bigger robotic devices that actually start to make what you need. So effectively, robotic machines, teleoperated from the Earth, can extract resources, store them, emplace habitats, lay out base roads and landing pads, and place solar arrays to start generating electrical power, and place a landing beacon so that every future mission can go directly to the same spot. Effectively, the people who go to the moon don't arrive to a wilderness. They actually move in to a turnkey operation. They move into an outpost that's already been pre-emplaced by robotic devices. And so the first task, the first milestone in that kind of architecture, is to generate enough consumables to support the outpost. So your first task is to make enough breathable air and water for the crew that will come and live on the moon. And once you've reached that milestone, the next milestone is to start making a surplus so that what you don't use is available for export. And then you start worrying about reusable systems and transportation nodes in Cislunar and creating the kind of reusable system that we talked about early in the program.
You'll like this question. This is Harry in New York, and he says, Paul, why weren't you considered as NASA administrator?
A lot of people don't like what I'm saying.
You know, stop on that for a minute. You know, it's hard to imagine why someone who wants to see the U.S. and the world become spacefaring and who wants to see humans settle in space and do things would have any real serious bones to pick with what you're saying. You're rational, you're sensible, you have an incremental, affordable way of doing things. You're combining science with human missions, robotics with human missions. You're building on that synergy. You're proposing all of what makes a complex program and system have a chance at working in the kind of world we live in today. So, you know, who wants to come up with something that's, you know, a better direction or something, and how could they really, you know, do that? So why don't they like what you say?
People have different agendas when it comes to space. And, you know, that's the one thing. Even Augustine said this recently. He says that they've gotten hundreds of inputs and they've got hundreds of different perspectives. And I can believe that because everyone has their own take on this. It all revolves around why you think we have a space program. In the minds of some people, we have it primarily to glorify our nation, very much like along the lines of Apollo. In my peer group, in academic science, we tend to think that we have a space program for our benefit, that the whole purpose of going into space is to send scientific probes and conduct science in space and to answer the great mysteries of nature. certain people think that we use space for national power projection, that it all revolves around asserting our status as a superpower in space. Some believe just the reverse, that it's all about peaceful uses, and in fact it's a way to prevent war by creating international programs where we're all bound together. Some people want to make a fortune. They look upon space as a frontier where there are fortunes to be made. Everyone has a different perspective. And so what I'm trying to do is envision a path forward that answers and serves as many of those constituencies as possible. Because, you need everybody's support to get behind one idea. And it seems to me that the idea of going into space to learn how to use what you find to extend your reach is a logical thing, because that serves all purposes, not just a few. And I just haven't convinced everybody of that yet.
See if we have time for this. Excuse me, this is Todd, and Todd is in New Orleans. And Todd says, you haven't mentioned the appropriate or proper use of the space station. Do you think there is a proper use in your space development plans for the space station? And do you support keeping the shuttle flying, or do you support letting it retire on schedule?
Okay, to answer the second question first, I support retiring the shuttle, for the simple reason that it's a very dangerous machine to operate and a very expensive one as well. That was one decision that I think was properly made. As for the station, I want to use it. I have a lot of use for the station. I don't think it's being used adequately as part of the exploration initiative, and I don't necessarily mean as a staging node, although I'm certainly not opposed to that. One of the architectures that we've looked at is basically using the space station as a staging area to basically gather the materials from launch from the Earth, sending cargo on slow boat routes using solar electric out to the Earth-Moon L1 point, and then sending the crews along with smaller spacecraft with faster chemical transport. So that's sort of a two-pronged architecture. They both meet at L1 and then descend to the lunar surface from there. I think it's a very viable architecture, and it uses station as sort of a transportation node. But the real value of station, it was built as a microgravity research facility. Well, there's a lot of things we can learn to do there, and I'll give you one example. If I were king, I would launch a ton of water to ISS, and I would experiment with it. I'd practice taking the water and cracking it into hydrogen and oxygen using the solar arrays, the solar panels on the station. I would experiment recombining that oxygen and hydrogen in the fuel cell to generate electricity. I'd experiment with freezing the hydrogen and oxygen to make cryogenic liquids. We don't really know how those actually behave when they're being transferred in microgravity. And I would develop systems and techniques to do that kind of transfer, because one of the skills we need to master is to refuel things in space. So there's an example where something very simple conceptually could be done on station, and it would have enormous return to any architecture you can imagine as far as going back to the moon is concerned.
What's the likelihood of using station this way?
Well, it depends on what's decided. I mean, if they decide they're really serious about going to the moon and doing the kinds of things I've been talking about, I'd say that it's very possible that that could be done. And it certainly makes a lot of sense. We're going to have to learn to master these skills eventually. So we have this asset. We have the International Space Station. It's there. Why not use it?
I wish I had saved this email that I got yesterday, but I trashed it. But a friend sent me an email, and you may know the company that I'm going to talk about, and I don't remember the name, and I hope I get enough of the details right. But this company has a business venture plan to go to the moon with certain kind of rovers that are able, and they claim they're already built and ready to be launched. And these rovers can design and carve into the lunar surface your corporate or personal logo that can, you're laughing, it gets better, that can be seen from Earth during a full moon, but the rest of the time you would need a telescope to see it. And they're planning to divide the moon into three or four segments to put these logos on the surface of the moon, and then they're charging $40,000 or $50,000 or whatever it is per logo of what you want on. I may have the pricing wrong or not. Have you heard of this company, and what are your thoughts on that? I mean, first of all,
But I do know that that would have to be one heck of a rover to be able to build something that you could see from the Earth.
Well, yeah, of course, and I can't imagine how they would service and maintain their rovers to begin with. But
you know, I went to see this new independent movie Moon a while back. The Sam.
Yeah, I've seen it with Sam Rockwell. Yeah,
Sam Rockwell, and I quite enjoyed it. But the one thing that really got to me was they're helium-3 mining on the moon, and of course you need to process a lot of regolith to do that. But one thing that really got to me is that they had numerous views of the moon from space showing these tracks where the moon had been strip mined. And, you know, I think that a rover or a mining processor that would dig up the regolith down to about a meter or so, which is what you would do with a helium-3 miner, would have to work for decades to produce a visible scar, certainly from the Earth. And even from orbit, I thought that was the one false note that movie struck in terms of realism. So I'm skeptical of this idea. I don't want to dismiss it out of hand because I don't know the details, but it sounds a little bit off kilter to me.
Is it? I mean, would people object to anyone carving logos in the surface?
Of course they would. I mean, people object to everything for every reason you can imagine. So, in fact, people object to what I'm proposing on the grounds that we're destroying a pristine wilderness. So, I mean, you're always going to have somebody who's got some problem about what you're doing for some reason. That's just a fact of a life in modern America.
Okay, listeners, somebody just sent it to me. You can go to universetoday.com, and you want to Google or you want to search for Company Looks to Etch, ETCH, Advertising on the Moon. They've got a YouTube video animation of their robot doing this on the moon. A new company is looking to sell advertising on the moon, not with giant billboards, but by a new technology called shadow shaping that can create images with robots that carve small ridges in the lunar dust over large areas that capture shadows and shape them to form logos, domain names, or memorials. Never in the history of advertising has the possibility of penetrating every market on Earth, reaching every person on the planet, and touching them at an emotional level only possible with the beauty of the moon on a starlit night been made available, says the website for Moon Publicity. 12 billion eyeballs looking at your logo in the sky for several days or every month for the next several thousand years. $46,000 is the starting price. I don't want to spend the time, reading the whole thing, but they got a big picture of the moon. It says your logo here.
Well, David, it sounds to me like you've got the perfect venue for a logo for the space show.
I just need $46,000. Can I get a NASA grant for that?
Yeah, undoubtedly you can.
Does this kind of stuff, maybe you don't know enough to answer this question, but does this kind of stuff detract from serious space business opportunities and investment opportunities or space science?
I don't think so. I mean, it's kind of fun.
Well, but they're probably serious.
People who are serious about investing in space and investing in the moon, they largely know what the problems are and what the issues are, and if they don't, they tend to, if you're going to lay out your own money on this stuff, you tend to educate yourself real fast.
Are you familiar with shadow shaping? Have you ever heard of a shadow shaping robot?
I have not. That's a new one on me.
Well,
sounds like a great idea.
Listeners, what can I?
I'm from Missouri, so you'll have to show me that it works.
Well, it's interesting. I guess the name of the company is Moon Publicity. So if anyone wants to check it out, y'all can go check it out. And if anyone from Moon Publicity hears this, hey, don't contact me with your hate mail. Come on, you guys do something this outrageous in your business plan. You got to expect to take some flack for it.
Well, they'll probably want to come on your show.
Hey, $46,000 per segment. How's that?
You can arrange a barter transaction.
That's exactly right. Before we leave today, if people have a question or comment, do they have a way to reach you? And you do have a website and a blog, which I will put in the archives. We haven't really talked.
You can send me an email at my email address is spudis, that's SPUDIS, @lpi.usra.edu. And my website is www.spudislunarresources.com. All one word, spudislunarresources.com. The blog is at the Smithsonian Air and Space Magazine website, and that the link for that is on my website as well.
Okay, and I'll put all of this in the write-up. Any concluding comments, or as we like to say, pearls of wisdom that you would like to leave with listeners today?
No, I just like to thank you for inviting me on the show. I've enjoyed it as I always do, and I do think that there is value to going to the moon. I hope I've convinced at least some listeners of that. And that it doesn't have to break the bank. We don't need to double the NASA budget to do this. It's just a matter of constructing a program cleverly and knowing what your mission is ahead of time.
I concur, and I hope a lot of people listen to what you have to say and what you have to suggest. And by the way, the PowerPoint that you used at New Space, is that available?
I will post that on my website. Several others have asked me for that, so I'll go ahead and do that, and that'll probably be up in the next day or two.
Okay. Listeners, when he does that, check it out. You'll definitely want to see that PowerPoint. Again, it was a huge hit at the New Space Conference. Paul, thank you very much for being back on the Space Show today.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Listeners, that's it, and our regular Sunday program tomorrow, 12 noon, California time. Thank you all, and goodbye from Dr. Spudis and myself.